Well, guys, that was really interesting. But Brian, you just can't get enough, can you? Because as soon as you were done with that interview, off you were with your tape recorder to track down the 20th century version of the prison labor system.
Well, I am the 20th century guy, Peter, but for once I was trying to make a connection to the 19th century. I'd been seeing these prisoner work crews, you know, the kind you see along the side of the road, and I thought, all right, this is Rebecca McClellan all over again. But when I actually caught up with the guard in charge, that guy who stands with the big stick and the gun, I really was surprised at what I learned in this interview with him.
Well, let's play that tape.
My name is Corporal Horace Bruce from Alma Charlotte Regional Jail. I'm the supervisor for the road gang. Today we is on Avon Street cleaning up.
My first question for you is this a punishment or is this a reward? I mean, I drive by, I think punishment, but then it occurs to me this might be better than sitting in jail.
It is. The guys enjoy coming out. I mean, they love the weather, they love the scenery. This is actually a gift.
So what have these guys done to earn this gift?
Well, depending on the years that they got, if they were sentenced for 3 years or less, they can actually come on board. A lot of guys can't come on due to the fact they got over 3 years and their crimes. Cocaine stuff, they can't come out. Assault charges, they can't come on. These guys right here is mainly child support, DUI type guys, so they can actually come out and work.
We are a history show, and certainly over the course of history, one form of punishment for people who have committed crimes has been kind of public humiliation, public shame. So putting people in stocks, and we've heard about the scarlet letter for adulterers. Is there anything about making these guys wear orange and having them along this pretty well-traveled street here that entails humiliation? Are they embarrassed?
No. Actually, the orange is an indication of the best inmates that we have in the building. The worst inmates, I say worst, the guys that can come out, they were black and white. These guys right here wear oranges, meaning that they are trustees and they can be trusted.
I tell you, I'll go get one.
All right.
Okay, I'm Brian Bowes.
That's Herbert Bowes.
Herbert Bowes. Okay, Mr. Bowes, I really appreciate you talking to us today. I want to get a view from your perspective of what this is all about. At least Corporal Bruce says that this is a privilege to be able to come out here, get a little fresh air. Now, he's carrying that big stick and has a gun, so I understand you have to think carefully about how you answer this question. But what is it like for you to, is this a punishment or is this a reward for you?
Mentally being away from my family, just being incarcerated, period,
sure.
That is punishment, you know what I'm saying? But as far as being out here, nah, man, it's a privilege, man. I love it. I get to come out here and get fresh air, you know what I'm saying, sunlight. A lot of people don't have that privilege, you know. They're confined to a small space all day, and I look at a whole bunch of other people that just like them. I don't know.
We're standing out here by a road. People are driving by. How do you feel about the public aspect of this? Are you ashamed, or do you see people you know sometimes? Anyone ever ask someone to get you a cheeseburger on the way, or how does that work?
Sometimes, see, I'm from Alamo County, so sometimes depending on the area we're in, I do feel a little shame, but I mean, this program takes very good care of me, you know what I'm saying? I get paid for what I do, so I don't have to call home, ask for money or anything like that. So basically, I see it, they're going to work, so am I.
Can I ask you how much you get paid for this?
We get paid $3 a day, $15 a week.
Uh-huh. Can I ask you how long you've been in prison?
I've been locked up going on 22 months.
And may I ask you when you think you're going to get out?
I'll get out December 19th, God willing.
May I ask you, and you don't have to answer this, what you're in for?
I'm here for a violation and driving on revoked license.
I see. Seems like a lot of time for a revoked license.
Yeah, well, after they see you for a couple of times, you know, more than twice, then they tend to lay the hammer down on you. So.
Yeah. Do you think all this time you've spent in prison is going to have any effect at all?
I tell you what, the last few times I came to jail, I didn't want to change my behavior. After this time, I can't do it no more.
What's different?
Age.
Yeah.
Like I've gotten older, I've matured.
How old are you, Mr. Buck?
I'm 30 years old.
30 years old.
Yep. In my adolescent days, I didn't really care. You know, I rip around the streets, didn't really care much. But now I have kids. I got 3 children, so they need a father figure, you know what I'm saying? And I got to be a role model. I don't want my sons to go through what I've had to go through.
Could I ask you how often you get to see your kids?
I don't see them.
You don't see them?
No, though. I don't.
Is that the toughest thing about being in prison?
Yeah.
I can imagine. Well, I really appreciate you talking to me today,
okay.
And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
That was Herbert Bose, a member of the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail work crew here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Before him, we heard from the crew's supervisor, Corporal Horace Bruce. That's the sound of a man working on the highway.
This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers. And I'm Brian Bellow. Each week on our show, we take a topic from the here and now and ask what history has to say about it. This week, our topic is punishment. Some of you have already sent in your questions and stories, and we've invited you to join us on the phone.
Next up, we have Micah calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Micah, are you there?
I am here.
What's up, Micah?
I was calling because I actually took a class last semester that...
We're already intimidated. Yeah, big mistake.
But go ahead.
But we did a lot of, I guess, looking into the way punishment has evolved over the years. And one of the things that kind of became clear to me was there seemed to be a sort of shift from focusing on the body of a prisoner to focusing on, I guess, more the mind and the mental state of the prisoner.
This was a good class, Micah. I like this class.
Good. And it seems, we started out with just really gruesome spectacles, and we've kind of transitioned into a system where we limit the body in order to affect the mind. You have prisons that are very harsh, kind of closed-in, sensory deprivation-type environment. So I was just kind of pondering what you all thought about that idea, whether you think that such a shift has happened, and if you do, what you think the results and ramifications of that might be.
Did you study in your class the panopticon?
We read Foucault.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
I believe it's the idea that the prisoner is under constant surveillance. Prisons were built so that the warden and the guards could look down all of the cell blocks and watch the prisoner 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it was a round building, and the guards were in the middle, and there were glass walls, and so that they could see through them what was happening all the time. And, Peter, that's an 18th century idea. So it suggests to me that the idea of surveillance is not a new one at all.
Right.
Yeah, this seems like a crucial transition, because in a way, being watched all the time puts you in this condition of anxiety and consciousness of surveillance, and that's really a move toward internalization. So rather than simply punishing somebody and being done with it, you're moving to a highly modern internal.
My point is that this highly modern idea is around for 200 years now.
Well, it depends on when you begin the modern world, Ed, and I would say that it begins with Jeremy Bentham and other thinkers of penal reformers of the late Enlightenment who were engaging with these issues, seeing that you couldn't make a better world by traditional forms of punishment.
Yeah, well, you guys make a great point, but I want to put another idea
great enough.
No, it's great. I just want to put another modest idea on the table, and that's the notion of bodies as productive units. And Micah, I think this gets you from the early period to a much later period, because for much of the 19th century, prisoners were used to make things and to make this country more productive. We were basically using their bodies.
And this is still a debate we're having. You used to say people today, this is such a drain on the state budgets. What we should do is rent them out to private industry and let them use them and put money back into the state.
But Ed, those people miss the main thrust of 20th century history, which is consumption. And not just consumption of things, but consumption of government services. And what is consuming government services at the fastest pace of any service.
Prisons.
Yes.
So what do prisoners do now? We don't make them work. We make them sit there and be housed by private prison companies so that prison unions and prison guards have jobs. Prisoners have shifted from producing things, using their bodies to produce things, to consuming these government services, wow, which are a key part of our economy today. How about them apples?
Very stimulating.
For us, too.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Moving right along, we have Pat from Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Pat.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
I was curious about the juvenile justice system in the U.S. and just sort of when that started as a separate institution from the way we treat adults.
Well, I believe that it begins with the very idea of the penitentiary in the early 19th century, because the rhetoric of the time was, let's see, how good an idea is it to take like a 13-year-old kid and put him in a big jail cell with, you know, 40-year-old habitual criminals? And so as soon as they invented the penitentiary in the 1820s and 30s, part of the idea was to begin to separate out youthful offenders from older offenders. But it took a long time for this to become more fully realized.
Yeah, and it did become fully realized, Pat, at the very end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, in large urban areas like Chicago, for instance, where they, to answer your question directly, really began to set up separate juvenile justice courts, not only keeping them out of jails for adults, but putting them through a separate process. And that was very much the product of these new social sciences that felt they could understand the way the human mind worked and the way humans worked collectively, and that the environment in which people grew up with was really crucial towards forming their personalities. And you needed to treat young people differently.
But of course, I think you guys are not going far enough back in history.
Oh, what a shock.
I have to say that the first thing is you have to invent the modern idea of a child before you can begin to distinguish juveniles from adults. And well into the end, toward the end of the 18th century, the idea of age of consent is much younger. And along with that, increasing attention to the boundary between childhood and adulthood, that's made possible different forms of treating child offenders. Children are now thought to be innocent. They weren't thought to be innocent historically in 18th and 17th century.
Yeah, I would make one other key distinction here, and that is when we begin to take what we would call juveniles out of the workplace in more formal ways. And that starts happening again at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. We start getting state-level child labor laws, and that really reinforces, in legal terms, this distinction between adults and juveniles.
So what's driving your question here?
I teach, and that's a fascinating, the relation of sort of like work to the ability of a child to work for the ability of a child to be punished.
Yeah.
I'm curious also about how that ties in with the way in which the education system has changed over the past 150 years, and if maybe there's been some parallel in how like corporal punishment in the classroom has happened and how various sort of means of detention have been employed in classrooms and how those have been employed in the juvenile justice system, and maybe there's some sort of like parallels between the two.
You know, we think about words that were created. The very word adolescent is in this period that Brian's talking about, late 19th, early 20th century. We became uncomfortable with the idea of people who didn't have a suitable institution for them at every moment, right? So we like the idea of extending high school and then go directly into the workforce or to the military, you know? And, you know, you think about juvenile delinquents. That's a dangerous combination, because a delinquent is somebody who's not fulfilling the responsibilities in either school or these other institutions. And the fact that they're juvenile suggests that we don't know exactly how to deal with them. You know, you can't really put them in prison. And so it goes back to these questions about what's the appropriate punishment. You know, you always think about, you know, Marlon Brando, the Wild One, you know. So what are you rebelling against?
Right. We start focusing on Marlon Brando, the Wild One, James Dean, and Rebel Without a Cause only after World War II, and we start focusing on them because that's the first time when most people are actually going all the way through high school.
Right.
And for the first time, we're getting a lot of working class people who wouldn't have gone to high school. Now they're in high school, and what do you know? The way they behave is defined as delinquent, almost by definition.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that what we've done now is evolved forms of punishment in school that are designed to destabilize the system as little as possible, you know?
Pat, help me out. It's been a long time since Coach Peoples took out his paddle and threatened to paddle me for not doing push-ups in the correct form. What goes on in schools today? I mean, what kind of punishment is used?
I mean, as far as I know, like, you just make people sit out, right? I mean, there's
time out?
Yeah, I think that's what. Or you have them sit after school, or they.
Well, no wonder kids are so poorly behaved.
I mean, I sit down for nothing.
Thanks for calling, Pat.
Sure. Take care then.
We have time for one more call, and it's going to be Amy from Wappingers Falls, New York. Amy, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
Amy, have you got a question for us about punishment?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. I'm in my 50s now, but when I was a child, I can remember hearing about people that had been to prison and they had done their time. When they got out, they were accepted back into society. And everyone said, well, they did their time. They've paid for their crime.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm married to a man that was in prison for 27 years. And he was released on parole, and this is in New York State. And now it seems like he's still doing time for the crime. It seems as if there's a second sentence, that parole is set up in such a way that it's hard to succeed or ever be forgiven or forgotten for the crimes that you've done. So I'm just wondering, is that historically how it's gone? Or is there more of a trend to not forgive and forget?
Well, I think the difference is that we have the machinery now to keep track of people for the rest of their lives. You know, in the 19th century or before that, people would get out of jail and go somewhere where they were not known, get out of prison and start over.
We've all got barcodes now.
Yeah, exactly. You can't do that now. And so we create the punishment that our technology permits.
So you don't think it's a change in attitude. You just think it's a change in technology.
That's a great question.
All right.
That's what I'm curious about.
Well, I think attitudes are shaped by technology. Certainly, if people in my period in the 18th century could have identified somebody as a criminal and known that this person was a criminal, they would have liked that. They would have wanted that kind of assurance. The big problem in the 18th century is you never knew who you were dealing with because confidence games and frauds and people making believe they were people they weren't, that was just the universal problem.
Right. And is it true in other countries too? Do they have the same type of forever parole that New York State has?
You're going to have to call a different radio show for that, Amy. We're the American history
guys.
Not the
world history guys.
You got any questions we can answer, Amy?
Well, I don't know. Do you have another minute? Let me stick my husband on.
Yep. Okay, great.
Cool.
Okay, hold on.
Hello, I'm George Oliveris.
Hey.
And you're the historian?
We are the history guys.
Yeah. My question was concerning the United States. Has there ever been prisons or wardens or Department of Corrections that have been held responsible or accountable for the success or failure of those that are released from prison?
Yeah, like school standards and so forth, huh?
Right.
No, you know, the only significant factor for politicians and criminologists is the crime rate and the perceived danger to the general population. And if the crime rate is down, the people don't care what brings it down.
But let me ask you, I understand from your wife that you've served time. So if you were director of prisons for a day, what would you do to change the way prisons are run?
I think the abuse that goes in would be eliminated. And I think I would not hold the men inside to a higher standard than I would hold my staff. And I wouldn't make them feel as if they're all failure and they will never succeed while in there. And the same thing with the parole. Many people are denied parole 3 and 4 times after they've gotten bachelor's and master's degrees. And once they're 1 or 2 years away from being released, when they go to the boards, they're denied because of the nature of the crime. Time and again, it just beats them down. So I think if I was warden or Department of Corrections, I'll have a staff that's conducive to them feeling good about themselves, and you start being treated with respect as human being, as men and women.
Did you witness any examples of that in your term in prison?
I witnessed it individually, certain officers, some staff members, but very few.
So what do you think does turn people around, such as yourself, who are able to make a decent life for themselves?
It's interesting because I feel that I turned my life around before my 25 years was completed, even though I was denied and had to serve 27. And some people, it's hard to tell when someone turns their life around, but something, it's inside.
But how did you know? Tell us how you knew.
How I knew, how I changed, how I felt. I started looking in the mirror and seeing the things that the inconsistencies in myself. I was saying one thing, and I didn't like who I saw in the mirror and who I was. And I started seeing how sometimes I was abusive, disrespectful to other men in the prison, yet when it was done to me, I didn't like it. So everything I started, the actions that I felt was wrong to me, I would not do it to anyone else. You know.
So in that regard, did the system work for you?
I think that I succeeded in spite of the system.
In spite of the system.
Yeah. Despite the system's boot in my neck, I succeeded.
But would you ever have been forced to come up with those inconsistencies? Would you have been forced to confront yourself without having been imprisoned at all, let's say?
That's a good question. What I have changing the outside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I would have changed in the outside. I know that after several years inside, I realized that that was not the way to go. I don't know what something else might have stopped me in the streets, but 25 years was much too much.
Yeah.
Perhaps in my case, I should have been stopped sooner. When I was convicted for 25 to life, I was already on bail for two other cases, and I had seven arrests, and at least five or six of those were for possession or the use or discharge of a firearm. So by that time, this is in a four-year span, by that time, I would have been better served if I had been convicted of at least one of those crimes and sentenced to a year or 2 years and given a taste of county jail or prison time.
So you needed to be punished sooner than you had been.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It's hard to get that balance right, isn't
it?
You mean for them to get the balance right?
It's hard.
For us as a society.
For us as a society, it's really hard.
Yeah, I can't remember a time in American history when people thought we had it right. And it seems like this is something we feel like we've always had broken.
We very much appreciate talking with you.
And with your wife. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I mean, that was a great conversation. You know, it brought out the idea of how idiosyncratic, how distinctly individual it is when he turned around.
Right. How do we know? How do you look inside someone's mind?
Right, exactly.
He himself was not quite sure when that moment occurred. So how can some giant bureaucracy know that the spiritual transformation has taken place?
Well, you know, I have a radical concept, which is that we might use history. I think that people consider crime and punishment kind of timeless, you know, kind of hardwired into the humans.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've seen in this show is that it's been continually changing. Every generation really has had a different configuration of what we thought might work and who we thought might need to be punished and what punishments we thought might be appropriate. And maybe if we didn't just sort of keep pulling the plants up by the roots all the time, we might have a sense
understanding. I think that's the best answer we've had so far.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time again. But before we go, I want to remind you that we can't produce this show without you out there. Have a look at our upcoming topics. They're all on backstoryradio.org. And leave us a comment with your own story or a question.
We're counting on you.
Don't disappoint us.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner is our engineer. Gabby Alter composed our theme.
Special thanks today to Jesse Dukes, Elliot Majerczyk, and Josh Dubler. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
And by Caroline Feeney, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, Dr. Anna McGee, and an anonymous donor. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.